the third case on the panel's argument calendar today is Colvin v. State, number 60181. Are counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, Ms. Thomas.
Good afternoon, Justices. I'm Jenna Thomas, appearing on behalf of the appellant, Rayshon Colvin. I'm hoping to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. This is a tragic case, and there's no denying that the facts of this case are very difficult. Nonetheless, it is our contention that Mr. Colvin did not receive a fair trial, that he should be entitled to a reversal of a judgment of conviction. There are three primary areas I would like to address today, and that is the exclusion of the defense evidence, the jury instructions, and sufficiency of the evidence. As to the first issue concerning the exclusion of the defense witnesses, the defense proffered the testimony of three witnesses from the detention center who overheard Crystal Hilburn, who is the child's mother, make statements that we contend are inculpatory and that subjected her to criminal liability and that should have been admitted. Specifically, the child here suffered severe burns. Ms. Hilburn told other inmates at the jail that she was holding her baby as her brother was cooking methamphetamine, and there was an explosion, and she was burned. The trial judge found that that was not a statement against interest because it did not expose her to criminal liability, and I submit that decision was an abuse of discretion. But it was certainly child neglect to allow a newborn to be in any proximity to methamphetamine as it is cooking. And certainly the exposure or potential for an explosion is always present in such a situation. Similar allegations have certainly been the subject of child abuse and neglect charges, termination of parental rights proceedings, and it is certainly nothing to be admired or condemned as a parenting practice. The trial judge also found that the statement was not trustworthy, and he relied primarily upon the medical examiner's testimony in making that assessment. We contend that that decision was erroneous for two reasons. First, the NRS 51.345 is unconstitutional insofar as it places an additional burden upon the defendant to clearly prove trustworthiness before the admission of a prior or a statement against interest. And the second, that it was an abuse of discretion under the facts presented here to not find those statements to be trustworthy. As to the constitutional issue, in many ways this goes to the basic foundations of our criminal justice system, that we provide for a playing field that is even between the prosecution and the defense, that the defendant's evidence is not subject to special rules before it can be admitted. And we see that chain of case authority from the U.S. Supreme Court establishing that point in case after case after case. The most recent being in Holmes v. South Carolina, a 2006 decision that stands out for many reasons, but primarily because it was a unanimous decision authored by Justice Alito, in which the court found that a South Carolina rule, similar to the rule at issue here, was unconstitutional. The South Carolina rule provided the defendant could not introduce evidence of third-party guilt if there was strong forensic evidence in favor of the state. The Supreme Court said that's not right. We allow trustworthiness credibility issues to go to the jury. We don't favor the prosecution's evidence. And there needs to be that opportunity as guaranteed by the Constitution to present evidence on behalf of the defendant, and that the South Carolina rule interfered with that right. Shortly after the Holmes decision, the Federal Rules of Evidence, Rule 804.3b3, was amended. And that the rule used to be identical to Nevada's in providing that evidence that was offered to exculpate the defendant had to have a specific showing of trustworthiness. That requirement is now gone from the federal rule, and it applies equally to both the prosecution and the defense, and there is not a bias against the defense evidence. Contend here that there is no reason to have an arbitrary distinction between defendants and the prosecution in introducing evidence of statements against interest, and that this court should find that provision to be unconstitutional and to strike it accordingly. I also submit that there is a statutory violation here, and that the district court abused its discretion in finding those statements not to be trustworthy. And I think it's important to look at the context of the statements. These were not people who were friends with my client. They had nothing to gain by going to a detective and saying, here's what I heard. We can't offer plea bargains. We can't pay for testimony. We can't go in front of the parole board and say, this person did a really great job on behalf of the state of Nevada. You should give them consideration. There was no benefit to these witnesses for coming forward and offering this evidence that was exculpatory to Rocheman so far as the burns and how they were caused. These witnesses also need details that they wouldn't be expected to know unless that conversation actually took place. They knew that Crystal had a brother who used methamphetamine or was involved in methamphetamine. They knew a detail that was so seemingly insignificant that it probably meant nothing to them at all, and that was the fact that the baby slept on a crack of the couch in the bedroom of the home. They also saw burns on the mother, which is a very significant fact. And considering all of this evidence combined, submit that it was an abuse of the district court's discretion to exclude this evidence. This evidence was critical to the defense. These were the only witnesses the defense intended to present. This was the only evidence that would have established that Rocheman was not responsible for the burns on the baby, but it was in fact her mother holding the baby as the brother cooked methamphetamine that led to those burns. And under those circumstances, especially in light of the jury's special verdicts in the penalty phase, where the jury found that Rocheman did not intend to kill the baby and also found involvement in others in his death as one of the factors.
Just talking about other causes, Dr. Olson had testified that blunt force trauma and those types of injuries were lethal, in that those happened about the same time as the death, and certainly prior to 10 o'clock.
Certainly, and that goes to the sufficiency argument, and as well to some of the lesser included instructions. Dr. Wilson's testimony, I submit, was rather weak, in that she acknowledged she didn't take a lot of actions, and there was no other expert presenting testimony about a child who was severely malnutrition, suffering from severe malnutrition, who's basically been starved from the beginning of its life. She performed no tests on bone density. She didn't know about what starvation would do to the normal healing response. But most critically, she didn't offer any testimony suggesting that that fracture could not have occurred as the result of an accident. She was clear that the infant himself could not inflict that injury upon himself. He couldn't roll off the bed onto the floor. But at no point was any instrument identified, any method of inflicting those injuries, and there was no testimony that it couldn't have been the result of an accident. Often in child abuse cases, we see the testimony that the fracture was consistent with the fall from a 10-foot story window onto a concrete. There's nothing of that onto a concrete base. There's nothing of that nature in this case. She basically said there was a fracture. She didn't even define at or near the time of his death, as far as what is near, and in no way related his existing medical condition to what impact that could have had upon a fracture.
I thought she did say that the fracture of the ribs were fresh.
She said the bleeding was. What she didn't say is that it couldn't have been caused by the CPR or the other life-saving measures that were taken with the infant. That testimony is just missing from her examination completely. When I'm a little short on time, and I'd really like to address the two jury instruction issues. The first is whether lesser included offenses of second degree murder and involuntary manslaughter should have been given. And essentially, this comes down to what does Graham mean? Does Graham, as the state contends, mean that never, under any circumstances, is there a lesser included offense to child abuse murder. It is borne in what the opinion actually says, which is if there are facts sufficient to find, if there's evidence that would support a lesser included offense, under the facts of the case before it, that such a lesser included offense is appropriate. Under the facts of Brown, this court said no, there were no proofs, there were no theories consistent with a lesser offense. It in no way said there will never be a case where such lesser included offense is not available. And this is a case where there were a great deal of theories as to how child neglect would have been a sufficient theory, leading to either an involuntary manslaughter or a second degree murder. And again, if you look at the jury special jury verdicts, I think those are consistent with the fact that there would have been a lesser verdict here had that option been made available to the jury. Finally, and I'm running out of time here, as to the accident language, I refer this court to look at the jury instructions 7A and 19 and look at the conflict that's created by telling the jury that the killing can be accidental, but the abuse cannot, when we're dealing with a single action here. This is not like a robbery that's one action where the gun goes off accidentally that's a second action. When we're talking about a single act, and to define that in terms of being accidental and non-accidental makes no sense to a jury. It's completely confusing. And when you add strict liability as provided for by instruction number 19, it's nothing but confusing. And I would ask this court to find that that language should not be used in child abuse cases. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time if I may.
Okay, Ms. Jones, Ms. Pesci.
Justices, my name is Giancarlo Pesci, counsel for the respondent. I'd like to start with the theory or the concept of an even playing field. That was discussed by counsel and was brought across in the brief. Specifically, this idea that 51.345 is somehow not an even playing field, and because of that, the defendant or the appellant, I should say, should get a benefit. But I say that I agree wholeheartedly that 51.345 is not an even playing field. However, the way it is tipped is to the appellant's advantage. If you look at 51.345, the portion of the statute that is not highlighted to you is Section 2, which reads, this section, which allows for some other individual to come in and say that they heard this person say that they did it, but they try to get these two witnesses. This statute says, this section does not make admissible a statement or confession offered against the accused, made by a co-defendant or other person, implicating both himself or herself and the accused. That is an absolute bar to the prosecution from introducing this type of evidence under Nevada statute. That is not an even playing field. This playing field that has been created in order to the appellant's benefit. Does the appellant have to go through the trustworthiness aspect? Absolutely he does. However, think about that. And we've been told to look towards the federal rules of evidence and how that shows how maybe we should change. Okay, let's look to that. Federal Rule 804, which was amended, subsection 3, which makes it admissible for both parties. Both sides, in this particular arena, the United States government, can seek to introduce this evidence because what is completely missing from the federal rule is what's in the Nevada state rule, which is an absolute bar on the admission of such a statement. You can go to the federal court. So the fine for the appellant would in essence say you need to go to the federal rules, which says that the state can introduce that. Think about that. Think about what you'll have to grapple with. A co-defendant statement. It actually says a co-defendant statement. Think of the issues with Bruton. Think of the issues of confrontation. But set that aside, the statute actually says for another person. So if the state of Nevada had evidence that implicates the defendant on trial and the person who says the statement, and it goes to his trustworthiness, it would be admissible. That's not what we have here. And that's a benefit to the appellant, to a defendant in the case, not a detriment. And so it's not that he is being treated unfairly in this particular situation. Let's look at the facts of the case, too, as to the application by the district court of this statute. All three of you have served as district court judges. All three of you have sat through hearings like this. You've had witnesses come in and testify. You've heard them. You've seen them. You've been able to make an assessment as to their credibility. Reading a transcript is not the same. Do you have the right to do it? Absolutely. However, the deference that's shown should be given to the judge that actually hears this. And it wasn't an offer of proof. Actually, it was an offer of proof as to the third witness. It was an actual evidentiary hearing as to two of these witnesses. Specifically, the court heard from Erica and Tiller. And heard from, in addition to Erica, Don McCarthy's. And then received an offer of proof as to the third person, saying that, in essence, the third individual would say the same thing as these two. Well, what did these two say? Specifically, Erica said the following as she was cross-examined. As you sit here today, you don't know when that happened, do you? Now, when that would be this methamphetamine cook that allegedly occurred, causing injuries to the baby that was argued by appellant below as the actual reason for the cause of death. Answer of the witness, no. And she didn't tell you when that happened, did she? Answer from the witness, no. So we have no idea on earth as to when this boil-up of methamphetamine occurred. Answer, no. It cannot even be put into the proper time frame in order to make this trustworthy. In addition, the next witness, Don Papas, said the following when asked the question. I think I interrupted you before. Did she say whether the baby was burned and how badly the baby was burned? No. She wouldn't get into that. And she said she left. The baby was still alive. But already burned? Yeah, this is the answer. Well, she didn't acknowledge that. That's why the district court made a determination that it wasn't even something that implicated Crystal Gaynor. These witnesses were inconsistent with each other and could not put it in the proper time frame, nor could they definitively say that the baby was burned. The argument was that Crystal said she was holding the baby when the batching and the methamphetamine occurred, that it blew up, and therefore it has to be that the baby was burned. Well, that's an inference argument that can be made, sure. It is appropriate for the judge listening to the evidence to determine that it wasn't trustworthy. It was not an abuse of discretion for the lower court to determine that these witnesses were not trustworthy. What cannot be forgotten in the context of this determination is these two witnesses, three, are given the benefit of the doubt of the offer of proof of the third witness, are wholly and completely inconsistent with the defendant's own statement. When the 911 call was made and the first responders got to the location, the appellant was present. The appellant told those witnesses, I don't know what happened. The baby was fine. I gave the baby a bath, put the baby down, and this is what I saw when I woke up. How could it be trustworthy to introduce the witnesses that I just described when they are inconsistent with the defendant's own statement? The defendant is stuck with this statement. He told the first responders there was nothing wrong with this baby. And this is what we had. A baby, speaking of those facts, who had a burn on 36%, second-degree burns, on 36% of his body. And when asked, because we heard some discussion about how Dr. Olson came up short on arguing from the appellant, Dr. Olson's testimony, quote, is it possible these burn injuries were inflicted the previous day, say Saturday, March 7th, prior to 10 a.m., no. Based on what I saw, no. Question, because there was no evidence of healing. Correct. There's no evidence of reaction under the microscope. So she did do more than just look at a picture. She evaluated this, and she determined that those burns, which in and of themselves could cause death, 36% of the baby, were something that could not have occurred before 10 a.m. when Crystal's in custody. On cross-examination, there was some push to try to push that time back. But nonetheless, you still have her testimony. And you have her testimony that there were two fractures to this baby's head. That there were two fractures to the ribs, and I brought up earlier upon questioning, there was fresh blood in these injuries. And those injuries are indicative of the fact that this occurred at the time of death. The argument could be made that some of his injuries were older. That could be made. However, the appellant is also stuck with the fact that he was the one who watched this baby on two preceding weekends while his mother was in custody on the domestic violence charges. It was the defendant who had the window of opportunity for the injuries that were older or could be pushed back to be older than 10-1 on that Saturday. Because he was the one who watched this baby. When you speak of malnourishment, those are incidents that also occur when the defendant has the opportunity to be with this child. The appellant argues that we should turn to these other cases, Holmes, and look to what Holmes says about this particular situation. When you look at Holmes, Holmes did not rule that this concept of requiring trustworthiness is unconstitutional or improper. In fact, in Holmes it said such rules are widely accepted and neither petitioner nor his amici challenged them here. That was not the ruling of the case. It didn't overturn this. It looked at the facts of this particular case, and in Holmes there was scientific evidence, fingerprints, there was DNA that greatly indicated the defendant. The defendant wanted to attack those. And the argument was that they couldn't because of that information. That was the determination, not that you don't have to have a trustworthy responsibility within the statute. And they also talked about the Summers case, how we should look to the Summers case, and that's out of Oklahoma, which referenced the Holmes decision. Now, the interesting thing about the Summers case is it was trial-specific. They looked at the facts of that specific case and determined that denying the admissibility of a certain witness or witnesses was inappropriate. And what's interesting is they also speak to the strength of this evidentiary rule. In their holding, they said, nor do we question the validity, in general, of this well-established evidentiary rule. What they talked about was when the rule was too rigorously applied. Now, that's just not the situation before this court, or the district court below. It did not too rigorously apply this, because the facts, as we've explained them to you, show that they were given the opportunity, that they were able to hear those witnesses. The district court determined that they were not trustworthy. They were inconsistent with each other and inconsistent with the actual evidence of the case.
Before you run out of time, could you address the issue as to whether or not the evidence presented warranted instructing on second-degree murder and involuntary manslaughter?
Yes, thank you, Justice. We look to the Brown decision to make a determination as to whether or not the second-degree instruction should be given, and for that matter, involuntary. Now, when you look at the Graham decision, it's actually very factually similar. In that it was a baby, that the baby was abused. The interesting thing, which is different from our case, is the Graham defendant actually argued accident. Not that it wasn't me, it was one of these meth people that were coming and going in our house, which was the argument, in essence, of the appellant here, or it hasn't been a clear showing that it wasn't an accident. They literally argued, in Graham, accident. And in the face of that argument, this court determined it was inappropriate to give second-degree felony murder because the facts of the particular case made it such. That's what we have before your honors. We have facts that make it such that this is the individual who is alone with this baby. The evidence was, from all the people that were able to have been in, that the door to the master bedroom was closed, that it was the appellant who was with that baby, and that they didn't see the baby, it was always with him. So there wasn't even an argument that this baby fell off of the couch or fell off of the bed, which is akin to Graham. And clearly, if it was not appropriate in the Graham decision with those facts, it's not appropriate here. And in Graham, the district court actually gave an involuntary instruction in the absence of second-degree murder. I'm just kind of curious when you think of it. And the district court was appealed on that issue, and the Nevada Supreme Court, this court said that it was harmless error to give the involuntary and not the second degree. The same analysis, even if you feel somehow that it was inappropriate, should be applied here. If it was harmless error in Graham, then clearly it's harmless error here. This is a case that's factually different. It's similar as far as the injuries, but different as far as the defenses. And so that is the response that the state would give on that particular issue. As to the instructions being confusing, dealing with instructions 7 and 8, they're not confusing in this sense. When dealing with felony murder, whether it's an accident or intended, if it's found that the predicate felony did occur, it is first-degree murder. That was the instruction that was given. As far as abuse being non-accidental, the instruction was given to the fact that it has to be of a non-accidental nature. They were instructed on that. They had the opportunity to determine that it was the abuse, not an accident. It's just like someone who shakes the baby. Clearly, shaking the baby is not an accident. Killing the baby in the process of shaking the baby could be an accident, in the sense that the individual didn't intend that the baby actually die. So those instructions were not confusing, not inconsistent, and it was appropriate for the jury to make its finding in that regard. And then with the third area of argument from the appellant, as far as the sufficiency of the evidence, we have laid out the fact that all of these witnesses testified that it was the defendant who was with this child. It was the defendant who was with the child when the first responders came. It was the defendant who said this child was just fine, and he gave it a bath, and then they had 36% of its body burned with second-degree burns. It had two fractures to its skull. It had two fractures in its ribs. Those occurred at or during the time of his death when he was with the appellant. As such, the appellant's motion should be denied. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Pesci. Ms. Thomas?
Thank you. As to the first argument that Mr. Pesci made regarding NRS 51.345 and the disparate treatment of the defense versus the prosecution, Mr. Pesci presents an argument that wasn't presented in the brief as to subparagraph 2 and its applicability. I didn't come here prepared to address that argument because it wasn't presented in the brief. I can tell you that that statute to me appears to be addressing a Bruton issue, which, of course, the constitutional provision would trump the statute, but there are going to be many, many other situations where that disparity does exist. As to the statements not being trustworthy, there are some inconsistencies between Erica and Don, and that's because the statements took place at different times in different locations, and, of course, they wouldn't be expected to be identical as they were not the same conversation. Erica was a roommate who overheard a conversation involving the third witness. Don was more of a confidant that she would meet out in the dining room, and they were in different situations. So, of course, there are some disparities there. I find it interesting that the lack of precision as to the date is an issue. When, if you compare the state's witnesses, the host of methamphetamine users that were coming in and out of the house, two of those witnesses were also confused about dates and had Saturday and Sunday confused. That wasn't sufficient to keep them off the stand. And that's because traditionally, over and over and over again, we hear that juries make the decisions about credibility. Juries make decisions about trustworthiness. Jurors get to decide the weight of evidence. As most recently in Perryman versus New Hampshire, dealing with the reliability of eyewitness identification, the U.S. Supreme Court said, reliability is an issue that the jury decides, and that's what should have happened here. These three witnesses should have been allowed to take the stand. Those issues could have been pursued in cross-examination. They could have been argued, and it was the jury's right to hear that evidence. It was Mr. Coleman's right to have that evidence considered. As to the earlier fractures, there was zero testimony, none, nor could there ever be, that those fractures occurred on a weekend. When the mother was home 5 days a week, and when she wasn't at Disneyland, when she wasn't in jail, the weekend stays, she was the primary caregiver. Certainly, she could have inflicted those injuries. We can tell from the record that she did very little else to care for this baby. There's a crib in the garage that she didn't bother to set up. She never took this child who was in clearly poor health to a pediatrician. Absolutely, those injuries could have been inflicted by her, or any of those methamphetamine users, including her brother. there was ample opportunity for other people to inflict those injuries. The state makes much ado about it being contrary to the doctor's testimony. I urge you to please read Holmes v. South Carolina, where the U.S. Supreme Court makes it very clear that the strength of the state's case, as far as forensic evidence, cannot be the basis for finding statements against interest and that type of evidence to be untrustworthy. Again, that's a decision for the jury. The jury gets to decide those issues. I urge this court to grant Mr. Coleman a new trial based upon the jury instructions and evidence issues, or to find that there is insufficient evidence in the first case.
Ms. Thomas, would you address Mr. Pesci's argument about the difference in Graham as it applies to the giving of the involuntary and second-degree murder instruction?
Certainly. I think this issue has to start with looking at the state's information and its amended information. Where it does not charge that this baby was killed based upon survey actions that took place on March 8th. It alleges the entire time, February 1st to March 8th. And it alleges acts of neglect, it alleges acts of abuse for that entire time period. In front of the district court, the state argued that Graham meant there is no lesser option ever. It did not say depending upon the facts of the case and the theories. Here there were many, many theories, and I've set them forth in the brief as to how this, the jury could have found the defendant here guilty of child neglect, how there could have been a basis for involuntary manslaughter or second-degree murder. And under Finnegan, Wagner, a host of other decisions, it was important that the jury receive those instructions. Even the day before closings, the state was acknowledging that it was probably right to give the second involuntary instructions. Then it came to court the next day and said, no, that's not right. Graham says there are no lessers for first-degree child abuse murder. It didn't say. It depends upon the facts of the particular case. And given that situation, the district court made the wrong call. Graham says there are circumstances, and this case presents those circumstances, where a jury could have easily found second-degree murder or involuntary.
What facts would make second-degree murder in a particular case like this?
It's easy to picture an accident happening, blunt force trauma of some sort, and not immediately seeking medical attention. That would constitute neglect or endangerment. That could either be second-degree murder, depending on whether it's deemed inherently dangerous and directly causal, or it could be the finding of an involuntary manslaughter. Not seeking medical treatment when the baby is obviously malnourished. The state here, unlike Graham, there was medical testimony. There was expert testimony saying that the three fractures on that child's head could not have occurred accidentally. And here, that testimony doesn't exist.
Why is there any defense testimony, expert testimony about the injuries?
It's certainly not in the record. I could guess that the medical testimony was so weak here that the defense probably said, let's stop now and not give them an opportunity to put in the better evidence. But it's certainly not in the record.
I'm just curious.
Any other questions by the panel? All right, thank you, Ms. Thomas. Mr. Pesci, thank you for excellent arguments. Excellent arguments today in your briefs. We appreciate it. Thank you. The case will stand submitted.